welcome to episode 2 of the Science and Dance podcast. It's great to be back again featuring our second guest so quickly after the first. Today I'm with Dr. Nikki Kay, who is a sports endocrinologist. She's also a sports medic, and her background is fascinating. She's grown up through dance and grown up with a big dream, and really passionate as a practitioner as well, with her research into relative energy deficiency sport, which is a mutation on from the female athlete triad and the considerations surrounding nutrition, training, and recovery. I'm really looking forward to this episode. I hope you enjoy it. As ever, if you could comment with your questions or comment with your thoughts and feedback below this episode, that would be fantastic. Share it on as many platforms as you can. And we're really trying to push the message out there from today's podcast. I hope you enjoy it. On to Dr. Nikki Kay. Hi, Nikki. Thanks for joining us. And I'm with Dr. Nikki Kay, who is an endocrinologist, an expert in terms of relative energy deficiency in sport, or we're also calling it in dance as well. That's right. Isn't that right, Nikki?
Absolutely. I mean, the acronym would get too long if we put dance in there as well. But of course, this is anyone that's active physically, and that, of course, includes dancers.
That's great. So, Nikki, for those people out there that don't know you or know about you, could you briefly just tell us where you started, how you got into the world of dance, and your background as a in sports medicine as well?
Sure. Well, I've always loved dancing. I've always been a dancer. I'm the sort of typical person. I started dancing when I was 4. I've never been a professional, but I've always taken it, I mean, seriously. At the moment, for example, I'm still doing 4 classes a week. So dance has always been my passion, but also I'm very interested in other sports. I was a competitive swimmer. I used to play tennis for my college. So, and my children are into triathlon and cycling. So my background, my interest, my passion is dance number one, but certainly any sort of sport. And then when I was studying medicine, well, I have to tell you a little story here. When I was 16, I wanted to go to the Royal Ballet and I did an audition, but I didn't get in. So I thought, well, actually, I still want to be involved in dance. So how else can I be involved, and how else can I make a contribution? Even if I'm not going to be, unfortunately, the principal at the Royal Ballet. So actually, I went on to study medicine, always in the back of my mind that what I was going to be learning about the body, about hormones, I wanted to apply those in the long term to dancers and athletes to help support their health and their performance. So that's really why I'm so passionate about dance, because I love dancing and I dance. and that's my connection, how making that link with my medical background. And I chose hormones as my field of particular interest because those are also fascinating. And you can't see them, obviously, but they're super important inside your body, not only just for keeping you healthy, but as we're probably going to go on to discuss in more detail, they're really, really key to reaching your full potential, whether that's a dancer or a sports person. So, yeah, there we go. That's my link between dance and medicine, hormones.
I love the way that you've drawn on that already, which is like the fact that something's so important, but we can't see it. And I think placing value on the systems and things within systems of the body that have this huge impact on the physical output that we all love, which is dance. And I think that's probably why, similar to why I got into strength and conditioning, is, you know, there are these adjustments we can make on such a tiny level that we can't kind of quantify and see them, but they're there and they're so crucial. So I think it's great that we've touched on that already. And you've even there hit the definition of kind of what endocrinology is. But just to briefly touch in terms of your field of research right now, Where are you up to with your medical research and your endocrinology research? What's the state of play within dance endocrinology right now?
Yeah, well, I think we've established that hormones, although you can't see them, they're super key there, and it's a network of hormones. It's not just one hormone. Everything works in a synergistic or interlay together interactions of all these hormones. And the reason why you go out and train, whether that's doing a dance class, whether that's going out on your bike or doing another type of training session, you do the training session, and then, but what, how exactly you go and do this session, and now you expect to get better. So next time I go and do an Allegro, for example, I want to be able to jump higher. That's the whole point of training. You want to improve. But the thing is, what is making you improve? And actually, it's the hormones are driving the adaptive changes in your body, whether that's the strength of muscles, whether that's more red blood cells to carry the oxygen around the body. All that is actually driven by your hormones. So that's why I'm so interested and fascinated by looking at the effect of hormones on your performance, optimizing your performance. I mean, anecdotally, we know that hormones are very important, because actually, not that I'm advocating doping in any way, I just want to say that, but 75% of the doping infringements are by using hormones. And that was one of the reasons my early piece of research work was to look at ways of trying to identify athletes that are cheating, doping with growth hormone, for example. Growth hormone is known to improve your performance. So initially, I started off, that was my very first bit of research, looking for the doping test for growth hormone. And then, very quickly, it was as soon as possible, I, of course, wanted to get some studies done in dancers. And this, so there were some studies I did on retired dancers, looking at the state of play of their bone health. And then I did a study of dancers in training, looking at their training load, what their hormones were doing, what their bone health was doing, because there's a fine balance. I've just said that hormones are very, very important for improving your performance and keeping you healthy. But there are some other fact. If you don't get the right balance right of your training load, of your nutrition and your recovery, really, then actually your hormones won't work for you. So it's getting that fine balance, and that's really the focus of my research, I guess you could say. And my most recent research was just in some male cyclists, looking at the balance of their training load, their nutrition, and how that affects their performance and their bone health. And just now, a little advert, please.
No
I'm just
problem.
starting a questionnaire for dancers, male, female, any genre of dance, ballet, contemporary, whatever, just to try and assess what's happening in terms of dancers' awareness of not getting nutrition right, and who's at risk. So that's just a very simple questionnaire, just approved by Durham University, which is online. And the more responses I get to that, then that will help direct even further research. And ultimately, we're always looking for ways of improving things. And so, but you need the information. You need to know what is going on out there. What are the things you can do to improve the health and performance of dancers?
And this is so current, isn't it? Because I mean, not only you've just given us a brilliant kind of timeline there from where you started in research to this is very much at the forefront of sports medicine at the moment anyway, in the news with kind of Caster Semenya on the front line of hormones, I guess, and hormone excretion within women. And it's actually so performance based that it's really quite close to home for dancers as well. It's making it very obvious to everybody that, hang on a second, these hormones that are in the news right now are even applicable to me and my performance. I think a lot of dancers are kind of going, well, have I got like the right amount, or not the right amount, but what are my levels of hormones? And I think that current research is super important, but we are looking to raise the awareness of these systems and these synergistic processes that you talk about as well. And I think that's part of the reason for having you on today, is to draw together something I'm very passionate about, which is nutrition and training load and recovery. But I'm very passionate about all those things, but I guess you draw it together in such a way that is, hang on, all these things that we talk about in research have bigger implications within the body. And I like the, obviously I haven't got a visual, but if I can, I'll put a visual in the show notes of a nice diagram you have, which brings together the training, the nutrition and the recovery.
Oh yeah, the triangle diagram, yes. Yeah. Well, I think if I can just say there, you're quite right to, you know, what we're trying to really emphasize is that hormones are crucial to your health and performance. Okay, so all very well and good, but so what can you do as a dancer or an athlete to optimize your hormones? Well, the good news is that it's actually under your behavioral control. Those three key factors, what can you control? You can control your training load, you can control your nutrition, what you're eating, and you can control your recovery. If you get those three things right, and you'll put the little triangle diagram up, you can see you're in the optimal in the optimal space for your hormones to work for you, and all's well and good. But it's very easy, and we'll go on to discuss this, I'm sure, you know, it's easy to get too much or too little of those three factors. So it's in combination. All those three things have got to be in the sweet spot, if you will. Okay, so, and that's not, I mean, that's sort of on first appearance, it's like, oh, well, that's easy, I just get all those things right. But then we go into the practical issues of how, what about, now we go in the finer detail, the timing of when are you going to eat your food? When are you going to have your recovery? You know, the training load, you know, to a certain extent is a little bit out of your control. If you're in a dance company or in a dance school, that these are the times of the classes, these are the times of the rehearsals. So, but you need to gel them all together. And then hopefully you'll get the right balance of all your hormones to support your health and performance.
So if we use that as kind of like a pretty neat segue into just picking up on one of those three things, which I think is probably in dance is the most talked about. I mean, training load obviously is a much bigger topic in recent years for dancers than previously. And recovery, we're starting to understand that, yeah, we need sleep, we need rest, we need potentially some recovery modalities if we're looking to perform. But the nutrition side of things, you know, we can have, you know, both insufficient and excessive energy intake. We can have insufficient or excessive energy expenditure. I guess there's all these things, that there's that whole system to balance. But what are the direct impacts of reducing this calorie deficit on our hormones? We know that it makes people lose weight, but how does that affect the system deeper?
Yeah. So if we just focus on that nutrition, just let's talk about energy. So the energy you need energy to run your body. It's like a car, okay? You need to fill up the petrol tank. And so all the energy you get is obviously from the food you eat. And then how do you partition that energy up? In the first instance, the body prioritizes the energy it needs to do sports training, whatever it is. So the energy is siphoned off to cover that demand, and then the residual energy is known as energy availability, and that you need that just for sort of housekeeping activities in your body. In other words, even if you lie in bed all day, you know, don't do anything, you actually need to still be eating food, you still need energy just to stay alive, to support those fundamental life processes, just to keep ticking over. And so the problem is, as you just sort of highlighted again, what are the things under your control? The things under your control are how much you eat and also how much activity you're doing. So if you have a really high training load, if your training load increases, then, you know, it can be easy to overlook increasing your energy intake to cover that. And that effectively is going to mean you're in going to the red in terms of energy availability. So that's kind of like an unintentional low energy availability situation. Although equally, and we know, you know, dance is as an aesthetic activity. We know that there's a, you know, you have, it's good to look a certain way for some dances. And also there's a, you know, a practical physical element to it. Having done point work for many years, I know it's impossible to do fouettés on point unless you're sort of, you know, pretty lean, lightweight, because otherwise it's just, you know, you're just going to break your ankle. Basically, you're not going to be able to do it. And also pas de deux, of course, there's, you know, if you're going to be lifted up, then to prevent injury of your male partner, apart from anything, you know, you've got to be a certain lightweight. So that's understandable, that's acceptable, but nevertheless, it can be taken to extremes, and people intentionally, dancers and also athletes, will restrict their energy intake. So now they need that amount of energy still. They're still doing the same amount of training, but they haven't got enough residual energy just to keep healthy, and they will end up in lower energy availability. So actually, maybe, Rupert, you could also put that little diagram I did with the bar chart. So basically, you take in the amount of energy you need to cover your training load and to just keep you healthy. Yep. That's the ideal situation. If you increase your training load but you don't concurrently increase your energy intake, then that can be a problem. Now you're in low energy availability. Or otherwise, you can also end up in low energy availability if you intentionally restrict what you're eating because you think that you will gain a performance advantage by being lightweight.
It rarely works out like that.
And initially, that might be true. Initially, you know, you might actually feel quite good that, hey, I feel a bit lighter, I can jump a bit higher, I can go faster on the bike. But that's like a fool's gold, if you will. If you sustain that low energy availability, then obviously your body has got to do something. It's now in emergency mode. What's it going to do to keep you alive effectively? So the body's very clever. It will switch off what it perceives as non-essential apps, if I can put it that way. Mm. So for example, in the female athlete, it might, your periods might switch off. You mentioned sleep. You might, if you're in low energy availability, you're not going to be able to sleep very well. The body's also going to try and save energy, through other means, like reducing your efficiency of your digestion. So lots of people present with what seems like an irritable bowel thing, but it's actually because they're not eating enough. So there are lots of consequences of being in that low energy availability. In the long term, initially on health and also actually on how you perform. Because obviously if you're really tired and your bones are weak, then you can, you know, an injury is far more likely.
So I think that's the next, that kind of links really well to, like, you know, there are consequences. And even though you might feel that there are these short-term benefits of intentionally putting yourself in an energy deficit, it's in the long term, you're really going to suffer. And this isn't just exclusive to dancers. I know it's kind of anecdotally and in the research shown to be dancers are exposed to situations where they are in a calorie deficit. But this is the same in endurance sport and weight category sport as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, the cycling study I just mentioned, you know, cycling is an example of a sport where training sessions are really long. I mean, I've got cyclists in my family and they go off to Surrey Hills on a 4-hour ride. It's like, see you later. And so if it's just a really long time you're doing your activity, so for example, if you've got lots of rehearsals or classes back to back, or you're on a long training ride, then, you know, physically, the timing, when are you going to actually be able to get to eat something if you're cycling along on the bike? It's actually quite physically difficult to get it down you. And also you mentioned weight category sports. I mean, that's kind of, yeah. So if you have to be a certain boxing and the martial arts, I understand there are certain weight categories. And so again, there's no choice. Otherwise, if you can't compete in that category otherwise. So you're right, it's across the board. It can be for an aesthetic reason, you know, dancers, divers, rhythmic gymnastics. Or it can be because it's an endurance element to it, that, you know, it's just lots of training sessions, like lightweight rowers, they train the morning and the evening. Cyclists have a long, you know, training rides and competitions. And all these sports also, in the ones I mentioned, the gravitational sports, climbing as well, by the way, that's a new Olympic sport. You know, if you've got to do something that's against gravity, sort of basic physics tells you, if you're lighter, then actually, you know, that could help. And as we said, it does to a certain extent, but it's when you get take it to the extreme and you're pursuing this thing, you think, oh, well, if I've lost a bit of weight and now I'm faster or can jump higher or whatever it is, the logic goes, oh, well, if I lose more, I'd be able to do that even better. But unfortunately, you come to that threshold, it's like, no, now it's going to be downhill, I'm afraid.
There's diminishing and returns there, isn't it?
Ultimately, the sad thing is that it will limit your potential. You know, in whatever dance or sport you're performing in, it's going to have, as you said, a long-term effect, not only on the health, although I have to be honest and say most competitive dancers, well, when I say competitive, I mean, you know, wanting to achieve, driven dancers or athletes, you know, I can tell them all about the adverse health effects, but they just want to know more about the performance. But, and that's where, the irony comes in, that what started out as a quest for improving performance actually ends up in being detrimental, to performance.
Yeah. And I think that circles back, pretty well to, in on itself. You know, it's this kind of like, at what point do we decide that we've gained our improvement from the stimulus, or the thing that helped us initially, and what point do we decide, right, that's enough now, I need to keep this this baseline level of what I've got going, I'm not going to get any more from just continuously manipulating this weight loss cycle. And I think that's probably the hardest thing, when people speak to me, it's one of the hardest things for them to understand and know when enough is enough in terms of being at an optimal weight.
Yep.
Have you?
Yeah, and also it's very, very dependent on the individual, because I know a lot of people like to use BMI as like, oh, you have to be, this is this magic number of BMI. If you're below it, you're not, that's no good, or if you're above it, that's fine. I mean, it's a very rough and ready thing. I'm, you know, I have to be honest and say I use that as a very rough guide, what the BMI is. But as we know, that doesn't reflect body composition, because if we did BMI on all the, you know, the English rugby squad, they'd all come out as being obese. It's just because they got so much muscle that it doesn't reflect that. So I think the first thing to say is that it's very, very individual, because a lot of athletes and dancers say to me, oh, but so-and-so is whatever, you know, eating this or not eating this, or so-and-so is this weight and whatever. It's like everyone is, although the basic principles of how your hormones work, of course, that's the same in everyone. The exact sort of fine detail of that is absolutely an individual thing. So that's the first point to say. And, you know, it is really, you know, discussion with your coach, your teacher, and, you know, being sort of honest with yourself, if I can put it like that, you know, how are you actually feeling? And there are studies to show how you actually feel is a pretty good reflection of your hormones, because hormones actually have a lot to do with your cognition and your psychological, your mood. So actually, if you're feeling good and happy and you know, then actually that's a good indication, probably, you know, you're on the right track and your sleep's all right. So those sort of subjective measures of well-being, actually, we shouldn't underestimate those, because not everyone can rush off and get a blood test to see what their hormones are doing. I mean, for females, it's pretty darn easy. There's an obvious clinical sign if your hormones are okay. It's, have you got regular menstrual cycles? If you got regular menstrual, all women of reproductive age should have regular menstrual cycles, unless there's an underlying medical condition or unless they're in low energy availability. So for women, it's actually pretty sort of straightforward. For men, obviously, there isn't such an obvious sign, but again, it will be fatigue, unusual fatigue, not sleeping well, all those sorts of things are little clues that you haven't quite got those three key factors right.
And I think that, again, it's potentially in the world of dance and certainly vocational dances, we've got better at spotting signs, certainly in the females, and open conversations about menstrual function have become a lot more prominent and are a good conversation to have where possible. But in male dancers, I guess that's it's not, we don't perceive there to be necessarily an issue there, and traditionally.
Well, I think you're right. There's in general, there's a cultural thing. I think we're getting over it with women. I mean, you could say, oh, that's awkward if a male coach asks a teenage girl, "Are you having periods?" But actually, it is a really, really important training metric. And you know, if that is an awkward conversation to have, then you know there are other ways of sort of asking that indirectly. For example, Gwen Jorgensen, the triathlete, she won the Olympics a couple of years ago. She posted all her menstrual cycles on her Training Peaks. So there are there are non-confrontational, if I can put it that way, ways of finding out that information for the female athlete or dancer, and of course making them aware that actually that's a really important thing. But for the men, it's probably, I have to be honest and say, probably it is a bit harder, because in my male cycling study, there were a few of those athletes who were or had been in quite a bad situation, almost a full-blown eating disorder. Because there's a slight distinction between a disordered eating and eating disorder. Anyway, suffice to say, they were not in a good way. I mean, their testosterone was in their boots, their bone density. I mean, they were not good. But it's perceived sometimes that is a sign of, quote, weakness in a male athlete to say, well, actually, you know, I have got a problem with, you know, disordered eating disorder, whatever. And we've seen that in the media. You know, people are very, quite rightly, ready to come forward and support and say, oh dear, how dreadful for female runners with REDS, relative energy deficiency, and sport and stress fractures. But a similar story on one of the cyclists in my study, he received quite a lot of negative comments. You know, saying, oh, that's just, you know, you're weak and whatever. And that is definitely, the culture's got to change there, you know.
And the culture's not just like that in that sport.
From that point of view. And I think hopefully we are gradually getting there. I'm part of a campaign called Train Brave, which is to raise awareness of this issue of REDS, the fact that it can occur in men and women, and the fact that, you know, we've already said, it's not just sport, it's definitely dancers. So I'm really important to get that message through. And also, maybe you can include in your show notes, Rupert, that there's the website I've written called Health for Performance, which again, explains what we're just talking about, really. What REDS is, what you can do yourself as an athlete or dancer or coach or teacher to spot the warning signs. And also some ideas, some suggestions of where to go for further information, etc.
Yeah, I actually shared an article of yours, which was a case study yesterday, on a female dancer from Health for Performance. People have messaged in reply to that article, like saying, actually, it's fascinating that this support is out there, and that there are... the future isn't so bleak. Like, there are people reversing this cycle, so they've ended up in a relative energy deficiency sport situation, yep. Whether that's from a change in eating pattern or training load, and actually it's been turned around. It hasn't ended up being a really long term problem, and they're now much healthier.
Exactly. So for sure, I mean, of course, it will depend on where the person is. If they've been in this situation for a long time, then obviously, as you might expect, it's going to be even tougher to get out of that. But certainly, there's always possibility to do that. But you've got to recognise it first, and be aware of it, and say, actually, this, I'm not, you know, I need to do something about this. And going back to what we said at the start of discussing this, that ultimately, it's also a psychological... I found that it was more of a psychological challenge than a physical challenge. So in my cycling study, for example, I took a group of male cyclists and I divided them into two. To some, I said, fine, just go and do your own thing. And to the others, I gave some educational intervention, some recommendations about how to fuel optimally around training sessions, giving them some skeletal loading exercise. That's not so much a problem for dancers, I know, but cyclists don't really load their skeleton. So, but actually what I found was that it wasn't that I was asking them to do something very difficult. Some of them managed to take on board my recommendations, and those were the positive ones. Their bone health improved, their race performance improved. That's the big carrot for the athletes.
Yeah.
But actually the ones that didn't do that, it wasn't because they found it such a psychological challenge to change what they had in their mind, to eat more or eat more effectively, or the timing of it. So it is actually the psychological challenge that sometimes is the difficult thing to overcome for people to recover out of REDS. And also, if you're in a situation of low energy availability, as we've discussed, it affects so many systems. Of course, your performance will be subpar, you know, below par, and your health, but actually it actually affects the way you think, your cognition. So, you know, you don't make necessarily the best decisions, that you can't rationally see that actually you're not in a good place. So that's where it's quite challenging to, you know, help support the person get out of that. But what I can say, definitely the positive thing is when people do manage to overcome that challenge and change whatever it is, the training load, well, it's going to be a combination of everything, isn't it? Modify the training load, modify what they're eating in terms of, it might be actually just a timing issue of when they're eating. Because that also affects your hormones adversely if you have sort of little deficits during the day. The point is, when they do that, then quite quickly they will immediately report back to me and said, oh my goodness, I slept so much better. I feel so much more alert. And it's like, yes, you know, I believe. I believe now this is the way to go. But you have to make that first step. You know, I'm always here to support these people, but I'm not a policeman. I can't force people to do this. But on the other hand, the positive thing is it is under the control of the athlete and dancer. They can change things around, and, you know, quite quickly they will start to realize that actually, you know, they do feel much better, and lo and behold, they also perform much better, which is, of course, what everyone wants to. That's the ultimate goal for anybody.
You're listening to the Science and Dance podcast. This is episode 2 with Dr. Nikki Kay.
So, I mean, we've touched on every single kind of, almost every single kind of consequence there of relative energy deficiency, certainly where there's either been unintentional or intentional manipulation of food intake or energy intake. But to kind of touch on some issues that are probably closer to home to dancers is we've already mentioned the menstrual function and the changes in that, and the kind of social acceptance of those changes is drastically changing. You know, we're doing better now with female dancers, but also the kind of bony stress injuries that seem to be so common, both from the foot and in some cases all the way through to the lower back in dancers.
Yep.
Could well be from these three factors as well, you know, this recovery, training load, and nutritional triangle. And those often, I mean, certainly in my experience of coaching, is that those have been bigger predictors of return to dance and health in the future. Probably the impact of the psychological impacts have a huge impact on these other injuries that we see as well. And a good associations with food, good associations with how much rest and training I'm doing. Would you say that they're a big indicator of
Sure. Well, that's a very,
as well?
very interesting, and there's just a study out recently that if you sort of go straight up to somebody who maybe has got a slightly disordered eating pattern and you say, hey, tell me what you're eating, most likely they're going to tell you what they think you want to hear, right? If you ask them about their attitudes to their training, which is actually, you know, something I'm looking into, you know, how do you feel if you, you know, you do feel really anxious if you miss a class, all this sort of thing, your attitude to your training, if that sort of verges on being a little bit obsessive, shall we say, then that's a very good predictor that actually you're going to carry through those same attitudes to your nutrition. So that's a very interesting point. But actually, it's also a little bit tricky because in order to be a successful dancer or athlete, or frankly, to be a little to be successful in life, full stop, you have to have a bit of drive and determination. Dare I say, even a little bit of obsession. And I include myself in this. you know, you have to be focused and all that sort of thing. And that's all those are laudable qualities. Brilliant, brilliant. But ironically, those sort of characteristics can also lead you, can go off track, shall we say. You can start putting those into being really, really determined and rigid about your nutritional patterns, you see. And so, and now it's a vicious circle, because I've just said that if you, we said earlier that if you're in a low energy availability state, then your cognition isn't very good. You know, you can't make really great decisions. So you see what I mean? So yeah. You've got, you're at risk, shall we say, if you're a successful dancer or athlete, of developing REDS. But equally, once you're in that situation, then it's very difficult to extricate yourself from that, because now you can't, you know, reboot your cycle. Well, basically, the idea is you have to reboot your hormones and your, therefore, your whole physical, all the physical processes and your psychology. So it's a two-way street. And I think that that psychological element is really important. And there's a study showing that there's a 20% higher incidence of disordered eating amongst athletes because, guess what, they are of that certain mental type, if you will, you know, driven and determined and all that sort of thing. So I think, but that's also a positive thing that I say, discuss with the dancers and athletes. I'm not trying to change you as a person, you know. That's fantastic. You have all this drive and ambition and everything. I don't want you to get rid of those, but I just want you to refocus them, please. And that's also what's going to help you get out of this situation. If you are in a bad situation of REDS, you've got to draw on that mental strength that you have that kind of got you there in the first place. That can also be the key thing that's going to help you get out of it.
I think that's so interesting to hear that what is a positive trait can also leave you at risk sometimes. Yeah, but exactly. Then again, you don't want to change that person. You want that person to be ambitious, and that's good. I mean, we within sports science, it's certainly over the past year, we're making some really big efforts to quantify how much dancing people do, and also what that looks like. What is the intensity of dance? You know, there's been cardiovascular research and heart rate research and oxygen.
Oh, you just cut out, Rupert. Hold on.
Sorry, have you got me there?
You're back again. You back were just again. Saying about sports science and psychology.
The sports science research is becoming so much more at the forefront in terms of quantifying how much dancing young dancers and even company dancers are doing, or West End dancers, or even on cruise ships, mm-hmm. by putting things like wearables and getting jump metrics and trying to find out how far people travel and how many high intensity efforts they make. For example, I know with the dancers that I work with, we do rate of perceived exertion for every single class that they do to try and monitor large fluctuations in training load. So I think that dance schools or even companies are trying to make more efforts to say, look, we need to know when we're working hard. We need to know when we need to step on a little bit so that our dancers can adapt to the dancing that we're doing, so that they can cope with the amount of dancing they're doing. But in terms of the education surrounding REDS, or in terms of the education surrounding nutrition, certainly, and recovery. How, in terms of the work you do, working practically with dancers or athletes, how is that going in the world of dance? You know, are people very receptive? And they're very receptive, certainly, of strength and conditioning and training load and the fact that we have to monitor how much people do. But in terms of the nutrition, what's been the response so far over the last period of time?
Well, I mean, I think positive. And I think going back to that point of you can't look at anything in isolation. Yeah. So, you know, as you say, monitoring training load is now becoming an accepted thing. And personally, I think what you do, the perceived exertion, is actually brilliant, because as I said earlier on, how you're actually feeling it reflects very nicely on your hormones. So I'm a big fan of that. But, you know, taking it as a whole, you know, dancers, you have to, as a dancer, you need lots of factors. You need to be physically, you know, have physical ability, obviously. You also need to have musicality. You know, you also need to have artistry. So it's no different than when I'm saying, that's how I sort of explain it to the dancers and athletes. You know, and if you're a cyclist, you know, you don't look at just one thing, do you? You don't just look at your heart rate. You look at your power output. You look at all the other factors. So the same thing, you know, you have to put in that equation your training load monitoring, a perceived exertion, for example. I think that's anyone, you know, that's quite a straightforward thing. You don't need fancy kit to do that. And equally, you don't need like super fancy kit for the nutrition and the recovery. You know, just recording or making a mental note or whatever it is of your wellness score, what is your sleep pattern like, how are you doing there? And just, I mean, I'm not a massive fan of like absolutely writing down every single thing you eat, because I think that can feed into that obsessive nature. Mm. But just keeping a mental list or just a very rough sort of menu in your mind that I've got to make sure that I have a carb and a protein portion with every meal. I've got to make sure that I'm never exercising in a really, well, a fasted state, effectively, a really low energy availability state. And I must make a mental note within 30 minutes of stopping your training session, whatever that is, a dance class, a cycle ride, whatever it is, within 30 minutes, I must eat some protein and carbohydrate. Unless, of course, if you're having a very quick shower and going straight to a meal, fine. But if often there's a lag and it's essential. So just making, you know, just having some sort of good habits, if you will. And, you know, like you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth. So, you know, I must eat these types of food with every meal and that sort of thing. It's just a simple sort of thing. For example, if you're going to do a class, you're going to make sure your point shoes are in good condition, aren't you? You're going to have sewn the ribbons in nicely. Mind you, in our day, talking about the end of the point shoe, we always used to darn it, but apparently nowadays you can just stick something on. Anyway, basically, you can make sure that your point shoes, you've got the right pair of point shoes you want to wear, that you're wearing the right kit and all that sort of thing. And if your bike, you're going to check that the chain and the setup, you know, these are things that you would do for the things you're using, right? Guess what? The most important thing you're using is your body, is you. So why would you not check all those things, you know, and be, attention to detail with all those three factors that you are with your point shoes or your equipment or whatever? You see what I mean? So it's just getting in the mindset, trying to change the mindset. It's like, you know, you've got to really be on top of these things.
And that's really applicable for the developing dancer as well, or the developing athlete, certainly. Yeah. Like, we've got, I really encourage like young people under 16 that aren't like full-time vocational to keep going with the sports that they do at school and their extracurricular activities, and all those things obviously add in from a motor pattern point of view, and like an injury prevention kind of, or injury mitigation point of view. Yeah. That's really, really important. But we, for parents listening to this or any younger dancers listening to this, those that just are treating this in the same way that you would brushing your teeth or wearing the right point shoes is definitely the message to get across. But is there special considerations we should make for young dancers as they're developing before the age of 16? Because there are situations where people as young as 12 have, as you say, either disordered eating or eating disorders because of their own influence. And as parents or guardians or teachers, what should we really be looking to as a red flag, and what should we be encouraging in terms of their activity levels and their nutrition?
Yes, well, that's a very good point, because really, you know, that age group, the young ones, developing, like you say, because, you know, everything is developing, bodies, minds, everything. So, you know, it's laying the foundations in terms of their health, but also actually in terms of their habits. You know, if they are have a routine, they know that, you know, this is how you should eat as an athlete or dancer. And definitely that's, the parents can be really helpful, you know, providing or reminding them. It's like, hey, you need to have that snack before you whiz off and do your class or whatever it is. Just being there to support. But you're absolutely right. That is key in terms of physical and just sort of ensuring good patterns. And I think also you made a very good point there that, you know, ultimately you might come down, my own children did this, you know, that I gave them an opportunity to try lots of sports, and then you come down in favour of one. So encouraging them, and there's lots of papers to say that early specialisation, just a mono sport, you know, at a very young age isn't actually advisable, because apart from anything, there's this burnout thing. I mean, you know, especially in swimming, and I have to say I was that myself, and even I saw that maybe was going to happen in my own children, that, you know, swimming, just mono, a lot of training, swimming, frankly, after a while it just gets boring, and, you know, they don't want to do that anymore. So mixing it up a bit, I think, is really important. You're absolutely right, the motor patterns, you've got to, everything is developing, including the neuromuscular network pattern in a youngster. They're changing proportions, so giving them little challenges, different looks at different types of exercise is it all also really important, and also fun. We mustn't forget this. I mean, you know, you know, let them, you know, have some fun, try things out, and that's an excellent time to put in the good habits with, you know, as a parent, you know, supporting good nutritional habits and all that sort of thing. And so I think the red flag, going back to that red flag, and I've had a few of these where parents have contacted me and said, I'm worried because, should I be worried because my, you know, young teenage son is like wanting to train all the time, won't eat any carbohydrates. It's like, yes. So those are the things. If the youngster is really, I mean, again, being keen and enthusiastic, that's to be encouraged, but really, really so like, even if they're ill, they're saying, I must go, I must go. It's like, hold on, this is now becoming a little bit obsessive. And, you know, saying, oh, no, I can't eat certain food types, things like this, or being secretive about what they're eating, or just changing a mood. I mean, I know teenagers can be a handful, but, you know, especially like a real change in character, that they're being secretive, they're being moody, they're being... They get angry if you ask, oh, have you eaten so-and-so or whatever. Those are warning signs. I think it's easy as a parent. You know your child better than anybody. So if this is a really, you know, you feel worried, then go on your parental instincts and get in there early. Because if you leave it, then, of course, you know, it can become more of an entrenched problem and difficult to do something about it.
And what about in the studio? Is it, or in the training room, or, you know, on the field, for example? But in terms of dance, it's certainly in the studio. Are there some noticeable signs for teachers?
Oh yeah, very good point. Of course, the parents, we've said, and the next, you know, the teachers, the coaches, they're going to, again, if you're, you know, you're going to know your student, okay? So you're going to see you're going to see physically, obviously, if they change. But definitely that coordination point is a very valid one, because one of the, yet another consequence of low energy availability and the hormones not working for you is actually loss of neuromuscular control. So that means coordination effectively. So they did this in female athletes, and they found those in low energy availability had slower reaction time and not so good at balance. And you can see, and that's obviously, especially in dance, you're going to see that, right? Mm. Very obviously, if there's for that student. Obviously, everyone is an individual, but teachers are excellent. That's what they're trained to do. They've got a very good eye. And so they're going to notice if this particular dancer that was, you know, at a certain level now is really deteriorating in their balance and whatever, and looking a bit on the thin side and not picking up corrections quickly because it's got a cognitive function. You know, you're going to be wondering, the teacher's going to be wondering, what's going on here? Is there something with the nutrition, is there something, therefore their hormones aren't quite working, and so for sure the coaches and teachers are absolutely essential in this process. It's another triangle, isn't it? It's the student or it's the dancer athlete, it's the parents, and it's the coach teacher. You know, they've all got to talk to each other, try and support the dancer or the athlete if there are warning signs, like you say.
Well, I mean, that's super insightful, Nikki, and obviously your research is continuing and has been ongoing for a while. And I was fortunate enough to see you present in Helsinki at the Dance Medicine Science Conference there. And I think the fact that there are resources now available to dancers, available to athletes that openly talk about all that triangle that I keep referring to, which I will put a visual up for, is so fascinating. So if people kind of wanted to get in touch with you or find out more information or dig a little bit deeper on relative energy deficiency sport or dance, or however long we're making that acronym, but where would they find you? Where are the best places to kind of read your research or get in touch with you?
Well, I would definitely suggest that everyone has a look at the Health for Performance website. This was a website I was invited to write and wrote on behalf of the British Association of Sports and Exercise Medicine. And you will see there, I've put separate pages for the dancer athlete, for the parent for the coach, and also for healthcare professionals. But please note that all those pages, everyone can look at each other's page, because it's got to be this multidisciplinary approach that we always talk about in medicine and science. Everyone's got to know, you know, everyone's got to be on the same page. So I'm very against having a closed shop. Oh, the doctors only talk about this and the athletes only talk about that. Everyone is in this together, as it were. So that would be the first thing I would say. Have a look at that. Scroll through. Have a look around. I think my contact's on there, or otherwise, maybe Rupert, you can put a link to my own personal website, Nikki K Fitness. It touches on all my papers are listed there. I do blogs, regular blogs. You can have a look at some blogs there, and also there's information if you think. If you're listening to this and thinking, actually, yes, I am either a dancer or an athlete that does actually need some help, or if you're a parent or a dance teacher or coach, then please get in contact with me. I'm now running a joint clinic with my colleague, clinical dietitian Renee McGregor, the Inspire Clinic. We're running one in Bath and London, and we see dancers and athletes with potential problems of REDS and eating disorders. So yeah, just have a look at those places, and very happy to follow up any questions people have or whatever.
That's great, Nikki. Thank you so much. I feel like because we've touched so much on the kind of nutritional side of things and the behavioural side of things, I feel like there's going to have to end up being a part two at some point down the line. But
well, that sounds exciting. Yeah, we didn't do all our case studies either, did we?
No, we didn't. But
yeah, part two to come.
But thank you so much for giving us that insight. And I have no doubt that people will be in touch off the back of this and certainly have more questions for you in the future. I mean, even I've learned a little bit more today and got me thinking about impact that strength coaches and physiotherapists can make to bring all this together and help. So once again, thank you very much. I'll make sure that all that everybody can find out where you're at. Thanks, Nikki.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rupert.